Should we take that out?
Get rid of the keyboard?
Get rid of the...
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, sorry.
We can take care of that.
Hi, everyone. Is that a good volume? Oh, you're so quiet and well behaved. It's not gonna work for me. It's an honor to follow you and like your work. Okay, so this is a work in progress from a big manuscript I'm finishing up that traces four generations of my family on three continents. And it's called, I think now, it's called The African Viking Girl's Guide to Returning. So it traces my mother's people back to Finland and Sweden, my father to Nigeria, and then our life here in this place called America. And I think what you need to know about it is I was raised in small town America with my white family, and I went to Nigeria when I was 26 and met my father and my siblings for the first time, and I was an only child prior to that. And one of the key moments in our lives was the Biafran War, which is Nigeria's civil war, which was the first challenge to colonial borders. And my father's tribe, the Igbo, were the ones who were targeted in this war, and we thought my father had been killed. We didn't hear from him for 3 years. So there was a lot of reference to the unhealed wound of Biafra. But otherwise, it's a really fun piece I'm going to be reading from. I tried to choose a selection that was particularly resonant for International Women's Day. But it goes back and forth. I'm in the car in Nigeria seeing my family, my ancestral village for the first time, and then it flashes back to my life in the U.S. So it'll be going back and forth a little bit. And it starts with two quotations. The first, "The land is the home of every being, man, and spirit. While alive, one lives on it. When he dies, he is buried inside it. Any person who has no land is worse than a slave." And that's from Igbo Worlds. Igbo slaves were described as, quote, "difficult to manage and disposed to committing suicide. The belief was very strong that at death one returned to the land of one's birth. Thus flying via suicide was a sure way, perhaps the only way, to get back, at which point one could be reincarnated and live in the land of family and relations, far from the experience called America." That's from A Quality of Anguish, the Igbo response to enslavement in North America. I can't really see this. "As soon as we cross the border into our state, the instant the Peugeot reaches the outskirts of our ancestral village, my father's body shifts. I see it even from the back seat, the way his thin shoulders settle, his sagging chin lifts. I imagine his chest, a weathered mahogany trunk powered by the pacemaker, creaking, expanding with the weather of home. He is back to Ala Igbo, the goddess of the earth, Igbo land. He claps my teenage brother, Emeka, who is driving, on the shoulder. Oho, what is this driving you're doing? He teases. Still shy, 12-year-old Adana lies quietly, her head in my lap. I'm still shaking, physically, from the car's ancient shocks atop the bumpy dirt lanes, emotionally from the drive through Aba, the so-called great market of West African literature and star of my father's letters some 25 years ago. I can't believe that the tout loud, traitor chaotic, oil black and dusty, unpaved sprawl of smoldering trash used to be something to write about. A market town established by our particular clan and then seized and turned into an administrative and military post by the British in 1901, a center of palm oil and palm kernel production, of kola nut processing, a polluted town on the Aba River. It's hard to imagine this is an affiliation I'm supposed to claim, or that it was the first capital of Biafra, or the center of anti-colonial feminism the very year of my father's birth. I grew up trying to ignore the world outside our house in rural Washington State, determined to resist this small town America place that was not Nigeria, not Finland, not Sweden, not like any of us. A dry indentation of earth cupped in a ring of sagebrush hills, holding black a big blue bowl of sky wherever we looked, the rattlesnake hills to the north, the horse heaven hills to the south, the sour smell of the feedlot at the entrance to the town enveloping the truck and worming its way through the vents and window cracks, endless days of punishing sun with not enough trees, cracked sidewalks reflecting the light from blinding intensity. Escape that. For years, I awaited the perfect half-Nordic, half-Nigerian creature, It would come scuttling over the hills, speak to me in a language that only we understood, and take me away. No one ever came. In the end, I got on a plane. It's Christmas, 20 years since the end of the Nigerian Civil War, 60 years since the end of the Aba Women's War. No one can bear to talk about the Civil War, but everyone brags about the other war. In 1929, thousands of women in the villages gathered to organize. When the new administration, the British administration, levied a new special tax on market women, 25,000 women shouldered sticks, tucked their wrappers tight, left their farms, and marched to town. "We've come to sit on a man," they declared, and all night they performed the sit, shaking their buttocks and singing songs of ridicule. In the ensuing weeks, some warrant chiefs resigned. In other districts, the women had to take it further, attacking British businesses and banks, breaking into jail to release prisoners, burning down courthouses to show what they thought of colonial law. When troops arrived, the women made obscene gestures and called them the sons of pigs that they were. The women then lunged towards the district officer, sticks in hand, and the troops fired into the crowd, killing 50 women, including the leader, who was shot clean through the head. Even after 300 years of slave trade, the Portuguese snatching up anyone they liked, and 80 years of British occupation, the Africans were stunned. What kind of men shoot women armed only with sticks? The rebellion, known as the Aba Women's War in Nigerian history and the Aba Women's Riots in British history, was the first serious challenge to British colonial authority in West Africa, and by the time my father was 31, he was free. The colonial entity known as Nigeria was independent. Ah, show her the tree now. Adana suddenly comes to life, popping up from the back seat, dark eyes bright, and pokes her brother behind the shoulder blades. "Ah, yes," our father echoes. Emeka nods and spins the wheel. The dirt road, so feverishly red and potted you'd think the wars were yesterday, grows suddenly cool and dark. We coast along in quiet shade. Ahead at the village crossroads, a large figure looms. The car nears cautiously. Before us, several paths and roads meet, intertwining and rising, swelling up into the largest tree I've ever seen. Later, I will learn that it's just a normal tree, the leaves used for soup. But it feels as if Loki, the half-giant from my grandmother's Nordic tales, has climbed out of the underworld to block our path. His feet, huge gnarled roots look taller than a man, erupt from rusty red soil. They arc and undulate along the forest floor, forming a series of natural seats nearly a block long. His leafy arms reach out, stretching from one side of the road to the other. The branches form a canopy over our heads, over half the entire village. My sister Adana warms her head, velvety skin, and rounded cheekbones into the crook of my arm. "See, see." At an African party in Boston, a Nigerian, one of the few willing to accept my claim that I am, in fact, Nigerian, swiveled his hips to the music and asked where my family is from. "Aba," I reply, as my mother taught me. "No, not where they are, where they're from," I repeat, the only answer I know. "That's a city," the man blurts with an impatient wave of the hand and some fancy footwork. "No one is from the city." At my blank stare, his rich, vowel, heavy language grows slower, more deliberate, louder, as if speaking to a child, and a dim one at that. "I mean, where are you really from? What local government area? The name of your village?" My tongue lies thick and useless in my mouth. What's a local government area? And why had it never occurred to me to ask something as basic as the name of our village? He has a point. I can't claim a thing. As he turns away, shaking his head along with his hips, heat flushes up the back of my neck, into my cheeks, throbbing in time with the drum beat. So this is what it's like to be black in the new world. Landless, despised, nameless. I get out of the car and stand on the land, holding the bones of my father's father, breathing it in like an addict. My nostrils strain, my chest seems hardly large enough for all this. This single moment in front of this tree is undoing 26 years of being black in America. 26 years. 26 years of never being able to stand up to cross-examination by Africans who don't recognize me, by whites who can't imagine me. I'm 5, 10, 15, encircled on the playground at the mother and daughter tea as they stare open-mouthed from my brownness to my mother's whiteness, to her, to me, to her, to me. I'm 25 at a party, hands outstretched as they dance away. 26 years, where are you really from? So this is what being African can be. I know our name, Adiere, in expectation of something great. I know our ancestral village, Opu Umobu Ungwa, local government area. I, unlike those who tried and tried and failed to get back, can come home.